All was silent save for the shushing of the wind as it stirred the old ice crystals on the glacier's face and the crunching of snow underfoot as the men-at-arms shifted their weight in readiness. Even Thick's humming had ceased. I spared him a glance. He looked perplexed, as if he were trying to recall something. When the Narcheska held her silence, Dutiful sighed.
"You know more of this dragon than you have ever revealed to me, and I have never mistaken this task you have given me for a maiden's challenge to her suitor. There is no woman's whim in what you ask me to do, is there? Will not you tell me the greater import of this task you have laid upon me, so that I may judge what best to do?"
I thought he had won her, until he added that last phrase. I could almost feel her distress that he might flinch from doing what he had said he would. I saw her retreat from the honesty that had tempted her into a pique worthy of any court-bred young noblewoman.
"Is it thus that you fulfill your pledges, Prince?
You said you would do this thing. If it daunts you now, speak it so plainly, so all may know the moment at which your courage slipped."
She did not have her heart in the challenge. I saw that, and so did Dutiful. I think it hurt him all the more that she flogged his pride with such a merciless dare, and it did not even come from her heart. He took a deep breath and squared his shoulders.
"I keep my word.
No, that is not the exact truth of it. I have given my word to you, and you choose to keep it. You could give it back to me and release me from this task, but you do not. So, by the honors of both my mother's and my father's houses, I will do what I have sworn to do." Webb spoke.
"This is not a stag you hunt for meat, my prince. It is not even a wolf that you slay to protect your flocks. This is a creature, as intelligent as yourself, if the legends be true, and that has given you no provocation to kill it. You must know."
And then Webb halted his words. Even as provoked as he was, he would not betray his prince's secret wit.
"You must know what I shall now tell you. He lives, this ice fire. How he does, I do not know, nor can I say how robust the spark that lingers in him. He flickers in and out of my awareness like a flame dying on a final coal. It may be that we have come all this way and arrived only in time to witness his passing from the world. There would be no dishonor in that, and I have travelled far enough at your side that I think it is not in you to slay any creature that lies defenceless at your feet. Perhaps you shall prove me wrong. I hope not, but..."
And here he turned to his witted companions.
"If we do not fulfill our prince's request to help him locate the dragon, if we do not unearth ice fire from this ice that grips him, I believe he will die, just as surely as if our prince took his head. The rest of you may do as you will in this, but I shall not hesitate to use what magic Ada has blessed me with to discover the dragon's prison and free him from it."
He lowered his voice. "It would, of course, be much easier if you all helped me." During all of this, the Hetgerd contingent had held themselves apart. I stole a glance at them, and was only mildly surprised to see the fool standing not with them, but beside them, as if to show plainly where his loyalties lay. The owl, their bard, had that listening look so familiar to me from my days with Starling. Every word uttered here would be fixed in his memory, to be later set in the swinging, lurching rhymes of the out-islander bard's tongue. Speculation and dread played over the faces of the others. Then Bear, their leader, thudded a fist on his chest to draw everyone's attention to him.
"Do not forget us, nor forget why we are here. If it is as your wizards say, if the dragon lives but only feebly and you unearth him, we will witness that. And if the Six Duchies farmer prince kills our dragon when he is in sickness and unwarlike, then all the wrath of every clan will fall not just on Narwhal and Boar clans for condoning such a cowardly act, but upon the Six Duchies. If the young prince does this to make an alliance and stave off further war with the gods' runes folk, then he must be sure that he does it in the manner agreed upon. He was to meet our dragon in fair combat, not ignobly take his head as he lies ailing. There is no honor in taking a battle token from a warrior who is already dying, and not by your own hand.
The fool stood silent through the bear's declaration, and yet something in his stance made it seem the man was his spokesman. He did not have his arms crossed on his chest, nor did he scowl forbiddingly. Instead, he looked deeply at Dutiful, the white prophet pondering the man who might be his antagonist in his quest to set the world on a better path. The look sent a chill up my back. As if aware of my gaze on him, he suddenly turned his eyes to mine. The question in them was plain. What would I do? How did I choose? I looked away from him. I could not choose. Not yet. When I saw the dragon, I thought to myself, then I would know. And a cowardly part of myself muttered, if he dies before we chip him out of the ice, then all is solved, and I need never stand in opposition to Chade or the fool. It was no comfort that I suspected they were both aware of that secret hope. Piotr spoke in reply to the bear. He said, in the weary way of a man who explains something for the hundredth time to a stubborn child, the Narwhal Mother's House accepts all consequences of this act to our own. Be it so, if the dragon rises against us and curses our descendants, if our kin and fellows turn against us, be it so. We accept we have brought it upon ourselves.
You can bind yourself,
Bear declared angrily.
But your words and gestures cannot bind Icefire. Who is to say he will not rise to take his vengeance on any who came here to witness his betrayal?
Piotr looked down at the snow in front of his feet. He seemed to brace himself, as if preparing to shoulder a heavier burden on top of what he already bore. Then he spoke slowly, clearly, as if saying his lines in a ritual, yet his words were plain as bread. When the time comes to take sides, lift your weapons against me. I vow I will stand and face them all. If I am defeated, let every man of you bloody his weapon in me before I die. Midway through his speech, Eliania had gasped in a sharp breath and surged forward as if to stand in front of him. He thrust her aside roughly, a harsher treatment of her than I had ever seen him make, and he held her out from him at arm's length with a firm grip on her upper arm as if to hold her apart from whatever he had just taken onto himself. Her body heaved as if she stifled sobs or screams as she hid her face in both her hands as he spoke on. If Icefire is all the legends say he is, then he will recognize that you have championed his cause, and he will not hold you or your mother's houses responsible for what we did here. Does that satisfy you? When his words were finished, Piotr abruptly drew Eliania close to his side and embraced her there, muttering words into her hair as he bent over her, words I could not catch. A terrible gravity had seized every Outlander face at Piotr Blackwater's words. Again, I was left groping after the full meaning of some foreign gesture. I felt that somehow he had once again bound them as well as himself. Was there some shameful attachment to what he had offered them? I did not know, but could only guess. Dutiful was a white-faced witness. Chade stood motionless and silent, and I longed to once more have the skill in me. It seemed to me that there was suddenly too many ways the dice could fall now. If the dragon was dead when we unearthed him, if he was alive, if he fought, if he didn't, if we slew the dragon and took his head, but Piotr died keeping his word. I suddenly found myself sizing up the Hetgerd witnesses as warriors, estimating who I could kill by fair means and who must fall to foul. A glance at Longwick showed him issuing soft-spoken commands to his men, and I suspected that the prince would now have a shadow at every moment of the day and night. But strangest of all, perhaps, were the actions of Webb, Cockle, Swift, and Civil. Ignoring all else, they walked a random, searching pattern over the snow and ice, looking intently down, as if each had lost a diamond and must find it amongst the sparkling crystals of snow. Webb was the first to find a stopping place. He was silent and motionless, waiting. Swift came to a halt perhaps a dozen paces away from him. A ship's length from him, Sybil scrambled down a steeper piece of ice and then stood still. Cockle was the last to choose his place. He had an uncertain look on his face. He moved slowly, hands outstretched and seeking, as if feeling for rising warmth where none could exist. Slowly he walked away from all of them until he came to a halt about 15 paces away from Webb. The minstrel appeared uncertain as he looked up for Webb's approval. Webb nodded slowly.
"Yes, I believe you are right. He is immense, larger than any creature I have ever seen. Here beneath my feet I feel him strongest, but if that is where his slow heart beats, or where his head rests, I cannot say. Perhaps it is only where his tail tip is closest to the surface. Each of you others, drop a token to mark where you stand. Then walk toward me, and tell me if you judge it as I have."
Cockle pulled off his mitten and let it drop into the snow where he stood, while Sybil plunged his staff in and let it stand. Then each made his careful way back to Webb. Dutiful and I exchanged a glance, and then, as if simply curious, walked towards the Whitmaster. I watched Dutiful's face, but I do not think he was as aware of the sensation as I was. It came and went, flickering like a guttering candle. Even when I stood at my prince's shoulder near Webb, my wit sense of the dragon was not consistent. But I agreed with Webb. When I did sense him, I sensed him more strongly here. Webb and the others of the wit coterie had kept their eyes down, as if they could see through the snow. Now, one by one, they lifted their gazes. Dutiful waited until Webb's eyes met his. I do not know what passed between them in that stare. Perhaps they measured one another. But when Webb nodded slowly, the prince dipped his head once in agreement. He turned to Chade.
"This is where we will begin the digging," he said.
Chapter 18. Ice. "My Lady Queen, you know I remain your most loyal servant. I do not question the wisdom of your judgment, but ask that you temper that wisdom with the reflection that perhaps what we have endured has pushed us past the bounds of justice into retribution. I assure you that the report of a massacre of piebalds is a gross overstatement. If we of the old blood have erred, it is in that we have held back our hands so long from taking the actions that will convince the renegades among us that we will no longer tolerate their incursions against their own folk. This is, in a sense, a cleaning of our own house, and the filth that we must scrub out of our blood shames us. Look aside, we beg you, whilst we scour from our bloodlines those who degrade us." Unsigned letter following the Grimston bloodbath. And so we dug in the ice. Longwick sent Riddle and Hest down to our camp to bring up the shovels, picks and pry bars. While they were gone, Longwick asked the prince solemnly,
"How big a hole do you wish, my lord?"
Dutiful and Chade drew it out on the snow, an area large enough for 4 men to work in without getting in one another's way. Riddle, Hest and I were the diggers. Longwick worked alongside us, to my surprise. I suppose he felt that his reduced company of guardsmen made it essential that he take a hand as well. The guardsmen worked with a will, but awkwardly. They were fighters, not farmers, and though they knew the essentials of throwing up emergency earthworks, they had never had to work on a glacier before. Neither had I. It was an enlightening experience. Digging ice is not like digging in soil. Soil is made of particles, and particles give way before the blade of a shovel. Ice forms alliances and holds tight to itself. The top layer of loose snow was the most annoying, for it was like shoveling fine flour. There was little weight to each load, but it was difficult to control where each shovelful landed. The next layer was not so bad. It was like digging old packed snow once we broke through the icy crust. But the deeper we went, the more difficult the digging became. We could not shove a spade in and lift and throw out a shovelful of snow. Instead, we used picks to break the ice into chunks, and in the process sent shards and chunks of it flying at one another. Once the ice was loosened, we could scoop it up and toss it up and out of the hole, where the others loaded it onto one of the sleds and hauled it away from the hole's edge. If I kept on my cloak, my back ran sweat. Taking it off meant that frost collected on my shirt. We did not work alone. A compromise had been reached, for the prince's witted coterie were the ones to haul the ice from the hole's edge. After a time, the two groups took turns at the picks, the shovels, and the hauling. By the first nightfall, we had a hole that was shoulder deep, with no sign of a dragon in the bottom of it. As evening fell, the winds rose, sending flurries of loose ice crystals scurrying across the surface of the glacier. As we gathered at our camp below, to eat our lukewarm food as we clustered about the tiny potted fires, I wondered uneasily how much snow the winds would sweep into our excavation. Although our earlier division had been forgotten in the day's labour, camp that night recalled it. We all huddled in the scanty protection of the circled tents, which broke the wind somewhat and gave an illusion of shelter on the bare and windswept ice. It was not a large space, yet within it we assorted ourselves. The Hetgerd warriors were friendlier towards the witted and the fool than they had been, trading rations and conversation with one another. Their skinny bard, Owl, sat next to Cockle while he performed for us. Cockle sang two songs without accompaniment, for he was not willing to risk either his hands or his instruments by exposure to the chilling wind. One was about a dragon who so charmed a man that he left his family and home and never more was seen. If there was some great truth hidden in it, I did not find it. As Webb had mentioned, it spoke of the man breathing of the dragon's breath, and in that moment giving his heart to the creature. The other song had an even more obscure reference to dragons, yet all kept silent and listened to them thoughtfully, as Cockle's solo voice battled with the sweeping winds. The only competing voice was Thick's. He sat near Dutiful, humming and rocking to himself. Although Chade tried several times to shush him, a few minutes later the little man would take up his music again. It worried me, but there was nothing I could do. I had glimpsed Piotr and the Narcheska earlier in the day, looking down on our work. Both of their faces seemed very still, caught between hope and dread. Dutiful had gone to speak to them, but I had not heard his words nor any reply from them. The Narcheska had stared at him as if he were a stranger accosting her when her mind was full of other matters. Tonight they did not join us for the evening food and fire, but went directly to their tent. The dim light of a candle glowing within it was the only reminder of their presence. When Cockle's song was finished and we had thanked him, I was full ready for bed. As much as I wanted private talk with Chade, Dutiful and the Fool, I longed for sleep more. My body had not fully recovered from my elf-bark excess, and the afternoon of heavy work in the cold had exhausted me. I rose, stretching, and Chade beckoned me to his side. When I went to him, he asked me to bring Thick to the prince's tent and help him prepare for bed. I thought at first it was an excuse to have quiet time to speak to me, but when I stood over Thick, my concern deepened. Thick rocked from side to side, humming continuously. His eyes were closed. I hesitated to touch him, just as a burned child hesitates to reach again toward the fire. Then the deadness of my skill persuaded me that any leap of his mind to mine would actually be a relief rather than a shock. So I set my hand to his shoulder and shook him gently. Not only was there no jolt of skill, but Thick gave no sign of rousing. I shook him again, more firmly, and finally had to drag him to his feet before he showed any sort of wakefulness. Then he blubbered like a suddenly wakened babe, and I felt like a beast as I steered him towards the prince's tent. As I tugged off his snow-caked boots and outer garments, all he did was mutter semi-coherent complaints about the cold. Without prompting, he crawled into his blankets, and I tucked them down around him. I had just finished when Chade and the prince came into the tent. "I'm worried about him," I said quietly, tipping my head towards Thick. From beneath the mounted blankets, a soft humming had already commenced.
"It's the dragon," Chade said darkly.
"We think," Dutiful amended wearily. He sat down on the edge of his pallet and bent over to drag off his boots. "We can't be sure.
We try to skill to Thick, and it seems as if he is there, but he just ignores us.
I delivered the news I had carried all day, like a stone. I've had no indication that I'm recovering. My skill is gone. The prince nodded heavily, unsurprised.
I reach for you, and it's like you are not there at all. It's a strange sensation.
He lifted his eyes to meet mine. It makes me realize that for most of my life you have been a tiny presence in the corner of my mind. Did you know that?
I feared that, I admitted. Chade and I discussed it. He said that you had had strange dreams when you were small, dreams of a wolf and a man. For an instant, Dutiful looked startled. Then a slow smile dawned on his face.
Was that you?
And Night Eyes?
He suddenly took a deep breath and looked away from me.
They were some of the best dreams I ever had. Sometimes at night when I was young, I would try to have the same dreams when I was falling asleep. I never had the same dream twice, but sometimes I'd have a new one. Even then you were teaching me to skill, how to reach out and find you. And Night Eyes, oh, Ada Fitz, how you must miss him. In those dreams you were one creature, did you know that?
Sudden tears ambushed me. I turned and brushed at my face before they could fall. I suspected so. Nettle sees me so, still, as a wolf man.
Then you went into her dreams, too.
Was there a note of jealousy in the prince's voice?
Not intentionally. For either of you. I never imagined that I was teaching either of you to skill.
Nettle I sometimes deliberately looked in on, trying to see Burrick and Molly, because I loved them, and I missed them, and because Nettle was my daughter.
And me?
For that solitary instant, I was glad my skill was gone. I never wanted the prince to know the role I had played in his conception. Verity might have used my body to get him, but he was still my king's son. Not mine. Not mine in any way, save the way his mind had called to mine. Aloud, I said, "You were Verity's son. I did not consciously seek you out, and I was not aware of your sharing my dreams, not until much later." I glanced at Chade, and was surprised to see that he was barely following our conversation. He seemed to be looking into a distance, and not seeing what was before his eyes.
"Chade," I asked him worriedly, "are you all right?"
He drew a sudden breath, as if I'd wakened him.
"I think it is the dragon that is fascinating Thick. I was trying to get his attention, but his music is strong and all-consuming. Neither the prince nor I can sense the dragon with the skill, yet when I reach after Thick with the skill, I can sense something there. But it's odd. It's like seeing the shadow of a man, but not the man himself. I cannot tell anything about him, other than that he's there. Dutiful says that from time to time his wit catches a whiff of ice fire, only to have him vanish like a scent when the wind changes."
I stood still for a moment and sent my wit questing. After a time I came back to them. "He's there, and then he isn't. I can't tell if it's something that he is doing deliberately, some sort of wit camouflage, or if, as Webb suggested, he's very close to death."
I glanced at Dutiful, but his thoughts had followed a different track. I wondered if he had heard what Chade and I had said at all.
"I'm going to try to skill to Nettle tonight," he announced suddenly. "We need a real link with Buckkeep, and she's our only hope of one. I also think that if any one of us can distract Thick from the dragon, if that is what is fascinating him, then she can. Even if it isn't the dragon, she may be our best chance of reaching him."
I was stunned. I didn't want him to try this. I did.
"Do you think you can reach her?"
"Perhaps. It would be a lot easier to do if I actually knew her."
The emphasis he placed on those last words made it plain it was my fault that he didn't. I think he had heard my reluctance in my question and been stung by it. I swallowed that and let him speak on.
"I only brushed minds with her that one time, and that was through you. Reaching her on my own is going to be difficult."
Anxiety gnawed at me. I knew I should not ask the question of him, but I did.
"If you do, what will you tell her?"
He stared at me bleakly before replying.
"The truth. I know it's a novel idea, but I thought that at least one farseer should try it."
I knew he was trying to provoke me. The events of the day had been difficult for him, and my prince was behaving like a petulant 15-year-old, trying to find someone to put the blame on. I tried again to let it go past me. "The truth is a large thing. Which part of the truth do you plan to tell her?" I asked, and tried to smile as I awaited his answer. "For now, only the parts that belong to me. That I am Prince Dutiful, and I desperately need her to pass on tidings to my mother, and then convey to me her advice. I want my mother to know about Siddle and her parents, as much to be wary of them as to rescue Siddle, I'll admit. And if she will listen to that message and accept it, then I will tell her my fears for Thick, that a dragon is stealing what little mind he has. Then I'll ask her to distract him from it, if she can reach him." He sighed suddenly. "I suppose I shall be lucky if I get that far in a conversation with her." He gave me another doleful look. I think at that instant I felt most keenly the loss of my skill. I did not want Dutiful to speak to my daughter out of my hearing and awareness. I feared what he might accidentally reveal. He might influence how she thought of me before I had a chance to let her know me on her own. He answered my thought as if he had heard it. "You'll have to trust me, won't you?" I took a breath. "I do trust you," I said, and tried to make that statement not a lie. "I'll be with the lad," Chade told me, and then laughed aloud at the dismay on my face. "No, don't say you trust me. I don't think I could stand it." "But I have to trust you," I pointed out, and Chade nodded. Then I asked, "What did you think of what went on today? Do you think that the Hetgerd folk will turn on us and attack if the dragon is unearthed alive and we attempt to take his head?" "Yes," Dutiful answered me, "without doubt. I think that the absence of the black man's approval has inflamed every superstitious fear that they have." "I think you are right," Chade agreed. I noticed that tonight, as we were retiring, they set up yet another offering to him at the outskirts of camp. I shook my head at Chade. "I know what you are thinking. Even if I could do it, I don't think it would be wise. If the offering was taken now, would not they interpret it as him finally approving of them because they had spoken out against the prince's quest? Too late for chicanery in that area, Chade." "I suppose you are right," he said without apologies. "And if you were caught stealing the offering, it might rouse them to immediate action. No, best to wait." He sighed and rubbed his arms vigorously. "I am so tired of this cold. I'm too old to be this chilled all the time." The prince rolled his eyes silently. I changed the subject. "Please be careful, both of you, when you reach after Thick. And Dutiful, be very wary contacting Nettle. I am sure I did not imagine what happened to Thick and I that day. Someone was using the skill to turn us against each other. Whoever he is still out there. He found Thick's mind once. When you skill to Thick, you may be betraying yourselves to him, and if he follows you, Dutiful, he may find Nettle when you reach for her tonight, or you may attract the dragon Tintaglia to yourself." I suddenly felt a coward because I could no longer hope to protect either of them. "Be careful," I said again. "I will," Dutiful replied irritably, and I was sure he was not giving my warning the weight it deserved. I looked at Chade. "Have you ever known me to be anything but careful?" my old mentor asked me. "Yes, I have," I nearly said. "When you went after the skill, you went after it with abandon. I fear you will do so again and risk all I hold dear in the process." But I held my tongue, and contented myself with a nod to his question. "It feels strange to know you have so much to do tonight, and there is no way I can help you accomplish it. I feel useless. If you have nothing for me here, then I'll be seeking my bed. I'm exhausted." I rolled my shoulders. I should have been practicing with a shovel those last months in Buckkeep instead of a sword. The prince gave me a grudging chuckle. Chade asked gravely, "Are you going to see the fool tonight?" "Yes," I waited, on guard. "Will you sleep there again?" I didn't ask how he knew I'd slept in the fool's tent before. There was no emotion in my voice as I replied. "Possibly. I don't know. If we talk late, or if he wants company, I may." "It looks odd to the others, you know." "No, don't scowl at me, that's not my concern. I've known you too long to have any illusions about your preferences in bedmates.
I mean only that it may appear to the others that you share his opinion on Icefire, that we must dig down to the dragon and free it rather than fulfilling the task the Narcheska has put upon our prince. I stood silent for a moment, pondering that. Then I said quietly, I can't help what people think, Chade. You won't avoid him. I met his eyes. No, he's my friend. Chade folded his lips for a moment. Then, very cautiously, he asked, Is there any chance that you could persuade him to our way of thinking? To your way of thinking, I corrected him. I doubt it. This isn't some whim he has suddenly conceived, Chade. All his life he has believed he is the White Prophet. Part of his mission in life is to restore dragons to the world. I don't think I can persuade him that that is not a good idea. You've been friends for a very long time. He cares deeply about you, Chade observed, delicately, which is exactly why I wouldn't attempt to influence him in that way. I pushed my hair back out of my face. The drying sweat from my digging was beginning to chill me. I ached, and not just in body. Chade, in this you will have to trust me. I cannot be your tool, and I cannot promise that I will act in a certain way, regardless of what we dig up. This one time in my life, I have to be true to myself. Anger twitched his face, and then, in a flash so swift I almost missed it, hurt. He turned aside from me, putting his countenance in shadow as he said, I see. I had thought your vow to the Farseers meant more to you than that. And, foolishly, I had thought that perhaps we had been friends a long time. Perhaps even longer than you and the Fool. Oh, Chade, I was suddenly so weary I could scarcely speak. You are far more to me than a friend. You have been my mentor and my parent and my protector when many hands were lifted against me. Never doubt that I would lay down my life for you. And he is a Farseer. Dutiful suddenly interjected, startling both of us. One whose vow to his family has already cost him many things. So, this time, as your prince, I command this, Fitzchivalry Farseer, keep your vow to yourself. Be as true to your own heart as you were to Verity's and to King Shrewd's before him. That is the command of your king. I looked at him, amazed, not just at the generosity of his command, a freedom that no other Farseer king had ever thought to grant me, but also at his sudden change from sulky 15-year-old to heir to the throne. He frowned slightly at my puzzled look, completely unaware of what he had done. I found my tongue. Thank you, my prince. That is the greatest boon that any Farseer king has ever granted me. You're welcome. I just hope that I haven't done something truly foolish. For we must both recall that regardless of what decision you make for yourself, I must hew to my promise to the Narcheska. I am here to take the dragon's head, and much joy may she have of a frozen skull. Abruptly he was a morose boy again. I looked at him, and was newly reminded of how difficult all this must be for him. He had left stolen kisses behind on Male Island. I doubted he had had a private word with Eliania since we'd left her mother's house. He shook his head to my sympathetic look. I can only try to do right, and hope that this time I have truly guessed what right is. That makes two of us, Chade grumbled. No, three, I contradicted him. He was bent over by the little firepot, and had succeeded in waking the embers to a single tongue of flame. He took a small piece of coal and added it to the tiny fire. I am too old to be doing this any more, he repeated his favourite complaint. No, you're not. You'll only be old when you try to stop doing this. I think this trip has done you good. I hunkered down beside him. Chade, please believe this of me. This isn't about whether you or the Fool pulls my strings. It isn't a contest of will between you two to see who holds my heart. Then what is it? He demanded grudgingly. I tried to give him an answer. I need to see what is true before I decide what stance I'll support. We've all known, since before we left Buckkeep, that there is an undercurrent to the Narcheska's request. There may come a time when you were glad I hesitated and did not blindly obey her will. Her handmaid, Henja, was connected somehow to the piebalds. I'll wager whatever you like on that. She and Pyotr and their mother's house defy the majority of the Hetgerd to put this condition on the prince. Why? What do they gain? What value to them is a rotting dragon's head?
She does not seem pleased with having to ask this of me, Dutiful observed quietly. She is hard as stone in her determination that I must do this thing for her, yet she does not seem to regard it with anticipation or eagerness, but dread and reluctance, as if it is not of her will that she asks this.
Then whose? Pyotr's?
Chade slowly shook his head. No, his interests run with hers, and she is loyal to him. I think that if she asked this to please him, she would take more pleasure in it. No. So, Fitz asks our basic question. Whose will? I gave my best guess. Henja's. She has power over them somehow. We have seen that, and she is connected to the piebalds, who have no love for us.
The piebalds? Chade pondered this.
Do you discount the fool's pale woman, then?
He asked the question keenly.
I do not know. What have we seen or heard of her? Nothing save what the fool has told us. The Out-Islanders speak of her as an old evil, a malevolence from the past, to be avoided, but not with the dread of something that lurks now. Our six duchies' dragons killed her and Kebol Rawbread, or so I have often heard. Yet the Out-Islanders still connect them with this island. They say they mined the black stone here to ballast their white ships. And there is no denying that the aborted stone dragon back at our landing spot stinks of red ship forging. A sudden yawn ambushed me.
Oh, go to bed, Chade rebuked me. At least you can rest. Tonight the prince and I shall reach far and see if we cannot persuade Nettle to aid us. I will admit that I long to know what is passing in the six duchies these days.
If the piebalds have stirred to action there, it might tell us that they play a double game.
Perhaps, Dutiful agreed with a yawn, and I suddenly pitied him. I was going to honest sleep. He had a night's work ahead of him. Yet as I bade them good night and left their tent, I sensed that he regarded Nettle as a challenge he anticipated, as well as dreaded. I set aside worrying about that as I left the tent. It was pointless. I was out of that game for now. Perhaps for always. I felt the earth lurch under me as I considered that thought, and then forced myself to go on. Would it be so terrible to go through the rest of my life unskilled? Could not I think of it as being free of the skill? I made a brief stop at the guardsman's tent. Longwick kept a weary watch at the opening. He nodded at me silently as I slipped inside, amongst the heavily sleeping men-at-arms, and then out again. He did not ask what I was about.
Chade's man. Chade's men, I corrected myself, looking around at the sleeping forms. Every guardsman on this island with us had been hand-picked by him, for both discretion and loyalty. How ruthlessly would they obey his commands? I was still pondering that when I paused outside the fool's tent. I listened for a moment to the sweep of the wind that stirred flurries of ice crystals in a storm at ankle height. Every now and then a gust would propel a stinging onslaught into my face. But wind and rustling ice was all I heard. Within the fool's tent all was silent, but the bright figures on the outside of the thin, tight fabric glowed with the life of the tiny fire within.
"May I come in?" I asked quietly.
"A moment," he replied, as softly. I heard the rustle of fabric, almost indistinguishable from the wind, and after a brief wait he untied the door flap and admitted me. Clinging frost came with me. It could not be helped, yet the fool still winced as I brushed it from my clothes. I took the bundled elderling robe from inside my coat. Here, I brought it back. He was reclining on his pallet, the covers already drawn up around him. The tiny kettle crouched hopefully over the candle fire. He lifted his brows and smiled.
"But I thought you looked so fetching in it. Are you sure you won't keep it?"
I sighed. His fey levity was too much at odds with all else I felt that evening. Chade and Dutiful are going to try to reach Nettle tonight, with the skill. They fear that the dragon is stealing Thick's mind, and hope that Nettle can distract Thick from Icefire.
"And you choose not to help them?"
"I cannot. I cannot find a single shred of the skill inside me. I only know that Thick is troubled because of the way he hums. Always before, he skilled out his music. Why does he hum and mutter now? It's a change, and I don't like changes, especially changes I don't understand.
Life is change, the fool observed placidly. And death is an even greater change. I think we must resign ourselves to change, Fitz.
I'm tired of resigning myself to things. My entire life has been one long resignation. I dropped the robe on his pallet and then sat down heavily on the end of it, forcing him to draw his feet up out of the way. I pulled my mittens off and held my hands out to his feeble fire, trying to warm myself.
Ah, Catalyst, can it be that you do not see all the changes you have made? Some by your resignation and acceptance of circumstance, some by your wild struggles. You can say that you hate change, but you are change.
Oh, please. I folded my arms upon my drawn-up knees and dropped my head onto them. Don't talk about that tonight. Talk about anything else but that, please. I can't think about choices and changes tonight.
Very well. His voice was gentle. What do you want to talk about?
Anything. Something about you. How did you get here, after we left you behind at Buckkeep Town?
I told you. I flew.
I lifted my head from my arms to regard him sourly. He was smiling a small challenge at me. It was the fool's old smile, the one that promised he was telling the truth when he was obviously lying. No, you did not. I spoke firmly.
Very well, if you say so.
Catrican must have helped you find passage, against Chade's advice. And you came here on a ship with a bird's name. I was guessing wildly, knowing that there would be some small kernel of truth at the bottom of his wild tale.
Actually, Catrican counselled me to stay in Buckkeep in our very brief meeting. I think it taxed her will to say no more to me than that. It was sheer good fortune for me that I encountered Burrick arriving at Buckkeep Castle as I left. But as I have agreed to tell this tale, let me tell it in order. Let us go back to the moment at which I last saw you, when I thought that you were hastening to my aid.
I winced, but he went on evenly.
The harbour master summoned the city guard, who were very efficient at removing Lord Golden and his belongings. As you probably have suspected, they detained me until after the ships had sailed. Then I was dismissed, with many apologies and assurances that it had all been a terrible error, but word of the incident spread. By the time Lord Golden returned to his lodgings with his baggage, his creditors had descended, convinced that he had intended to flee the city without paying them, as indeed he had. They were happy to confiscate most of his baggage and gear, all save one pack containing the absolute minimum essentials for his survival, which he'd had the forethought to leave in his Buckkeep chambers.
The little copper kettle was puffing steam. He lifted it from the small flame and poured water into a gaily decorated teapot. I had to smile. I gestured about the tent. The bare essentials. He arched one golden brow.
For civilized adventuring, yes.
He put the lid on the teapot. It was shaped like a rose.
And why should one attempt to get by with less? Now, where was I? Ah, yes, Lord Golden, stripped of his possessions and glamour, was no longer Lord Golden, but only a fleeing debtor. Those who thought they knew him best were astonished at the way he lithely spidered down the outside of his lodgings to land lightly on his feet and run off into the alleys. I vanished.
He made me wait. He rubbed one eye and smiled at me thoughtfully. I bit the inside of my cheek until he finally gave in and went on.
I went to Catrican, by ways and means that I shall leave to your imagination. I think she was quite astounded to encounter me waiting for her in her bedchamber. As I have told you, she urged me to stay at Buckkeep within the castle under her wing until you had completed her mission. I had to decline, of course, and,
here he hesitated for a time,
I had words with Burrick. I think you know that already, or suspect it. It shocked me that he recognized me immediately, much as you had. He asked me questions, not because he needed answers, but to confirm what he had already ciphered out for himself from an earlier interview with Catrican.
He paused so long that I feared he would not go on. Then he said softly,
"At one point he was so furious at what I told him, I thought he would strike me dead. Then, abruptly, he began to weep. And again he halted. I sat there, my tongue turned to ashes in my mouth. Almost I hoped he would not go on. When he did, I know he left much unsaid. Bereft of any support from the castle, I foolishly thought to return to my inn to see what rags of my fortunes my creditors might have left me to aid me in my flight. My stripped apartments looked as if a horde of locusts had despoiled them. Yet worse was to come. The landlord had seen me enter, and he had taken bribes from my creditors to contact them immediately if he heard or saw me. And he earned his greasy coins well. For a second wave of furious former friends appeared. You would have thought that they had honestly earned the money that they had won in wages from me, so righteously outraged were they. So, once more, I fled. This time I fled the entire city, not so much in fear of my creditors as in fury at my friends. You had betrayed me, Fitz, and yet perhaps it was your turn to betray me, given that I had so badly failed you. What? I was astounded that he could say such a thing, but when our gazes met, I saw ancient shame in his deepening eyes, and recalled a time in the mountains when my enemies had used him against me. You know I never counted that against you. It was not you, fool, it wasn't. And perhaps when you betrayed me, it was more chade than you. But the damage was done, nonetheless. And I was furious, and frightened, and desolated to think that perhaps I had come so far only to be defeated by him I most trusted. I fled Buckkeep on foot, eluding my pursuers, yet knowing I could not do so for long, and wondering what I might do next. How could it be, I wondered, that the Catalyst could change events so that the White Prophet was so completely defeated? And slowly it came to me that it could not be so, that there was a deeper pattern at work than I had first glimpsed. I resolved to give myself to it, though I could not guess what it might be. I had turned my head on my arms so I could watch him as he told the story. Now I gave a sigh and relaxed into my hunch. He reached from beneath the covers to pour a scanty share of tea into a cup and a bowl, then gestured that I should take whichever I wished. The pot had plainly been made for one person, travelling alone, and it touched me that he still offered to share. I lifted the bowl and sipped from it. It tasted like flowers, a mouthful of summer in this land where winter always reigned. The heat of it was fleeing rapidly, briefly warming my hands as it passed through the crockery. The fool's long, elegant fingers wrapped the cup as he drank his share. "Go on," I urged him, when he had let the silence grow. I knew it was a trick of the storyteller to do so, but I did not begrudge him the drama. "Well, my second horde of creditors had paid heed to the tales of the first. They were soon after me. I ran, and swiftly, but Lord Golden's dress was a bit ostentatious to blend in with the crowd, and my pack encumbered me. You recall the hill outside Buckkeep where the witness stone stands still?" Of course. I was intrigued. It was the last place I would have fled to. The bare black stones stand upon the barren hillside there, as they have always stood, weathered and impervious to all. The folk of the Six Duchies have long used them as an oath place. Lovers pledge to one another there. It is said that if two men duel there, the gods will see that justice is done. The righteous will win there, if nowhere else. It is an oddly solemn place, bereft of brush or clinging vines. There would be no cover there for any hunted creature to hide in. But why go there? He lifted one narrow shoulder in an eloquent shrug. I knew I could not get far. If I were captured and taken back to Buckkeep, doubtless my creditors would have not only taken my kit, but put me to drudgery to work off my debt. I and my mission in the world would be completely undone. So I resolved to rely on fate, and test an idea that I formulated long ago. The witness stones are gateway stones, Fitz, just like the skill pillars that you have used before when in dire need to flee. Except, of course, that long ago someone or something obliterated the runes from the sides of the witness stones. Perhaps they are so old that they wore away naturally. Perhaps some ancient skill user decided to put an end to their usefulness. In any case, the runes that tell where they lead are gone, leaving only the weathered marks where they used to be. As I ran toward them, my pack heavy on my back,
I thought back over what you had told me of your adventure on the treasure beach with Prince Dutiful. I knew that I might choose the wrong facet of the stone and find myself plunged into deep, cold water. I sat up straight in slow, cold horror. Fool! It is far worse than that. What if a stone had fallen face down and you were flung from it into solid earth? Or what if you choose a destination where the stone had been shattered, or...
All those thoughts rushed through my mind as I raced toward it. Fortunately, there was no time for me to choose, no time for me even to wonder if there was enough of the skill left on my fingers to work the stone. I struck the stone, fingertips first, knowing only that I must pass through the portal.
He paused. I was leaning intently toward him, my heart in my throat. To pass through a skill portal had always been difficult for me. We knew so little about them, only that some standing stones carved of memory stone and marked with runes could serve as passageways to distant places. I had used them less than a dozen times in my life, and never without dread and uneasiness. Some of Regal's inexperienced skill users had lost their minds when they were forced to use the skill portals. Using one had jumbled Dutiful's memory of our time on the treasure beach and left us both exhausted. The fool smiled sweetly at me. "Don't look like that. You know I survived."
"At what cost?" I asked, knowing there must be one.
"Exhaustion. I emerged somewhere. I have no idea where. Nowhere I've ever been before. It was a city in ruins, and still as dead stone can be. There was a river near it, that is as much as I can tell you. I slept, I don't know how long. When I awoke, dawn was all around me, and the skill pillar towered over me. This one shone clean of lichen or moss, with each rune standing out as clear as if they had been chiselled yesterday. I studied them for a long time, afraid and dreading, and yet knowing they offered me my only hope. I narrowed my choices down to two of them, that might possibly be the one I wished. And then I entered the pillar again.
No,
I groaned. Exactly how I felt. I emerged feeling as if I had taken a bad beating, but I had come to the right place. He made me ask the question, enjoying it.
Where?
Do you remember the broken plaza? Like an ancient market circle, the one where the forest was trying to encroach. I stood on top of a stone pillar there, and for a moment, in a dream, I wore the rooster crown. You saw me. You remember it.
I nodded slowly. It was on our road to the stone garden, where the stone dragons slept, before we roused them and sent them to fight the red ships. Where they sleep again now, Verity as dragon amongst them.
Exactly. Again, I went down that forest path, and I saw him there. But he was not the one I sought. I found girl on a dragon there, sleeping, her arms clasping the neck of her dragon, just as you had told me. And I woke her, and made her understand that I must come here. And once again I mounted behind her, and she flew here with me, and left me. So you see, old friend, I did not lie to you. I flew here.
I sat bolt upright, suddenly wide awake. 100 questions swelled in me, but I asked the most important one. How did you wake her? It takes the wit, the skill, and blood to wake a stone dragon. Well do I know that.
It did, and it does. The skill I had on my fingertips, and blood was easy enough to come by. He rubbed his wrist, possibly remembering an old cut. I did not, and do not have the wit. But you may remember that, foolishly, I had already put some of myself into Girl on a Dragon when I was attempting to complete the carving of her and wake her.
As did I recalled guiltily.
Yes, I know,
he said softly.
It is still in her. You put in the memories you could not stand to recall and the emotions you would not let yourself feel. You gave her your mother abandoning you and never knowing your father. You gave her Regal's torment of you in his dungeons. You gave her, most of all, the pain of losing Molly and your child to Burrick, of all people. You put into her your fury and your hurt and your sense of being betrayed.
He gave a little sigh.
It is all in her still. The things you could not allow yourself to feel.
I left all that behind me long ago, I said slowly.
You cut out a part of yourself and went on, less than you had been.
I do not see it that way. My reply was stiff.
You cannot see it that way, he informed me calmly, because you cannot truly remember how awful any of it was, because you put all of it into Girl on a Dragon.
Can we leave this? I asked, almost frightened, almost angry, but confused over what would scare or anger me.
We must, because you already left it long years ago, and only I will ever know the full depth of what you felt about those things. Only I fully remember who and what you were before you did it, for we are bound together, not only by skill and fate, but also because both of us live on, inside Girl on a Dragon. Because I knew what went into her, I could reach her and rouse her. I could convey to her my desperate purpose. And so she brought me to Aslivjal. It was a strange journey, wild and wonderful. You know I have ridden with her before. I was with her when she and the other dragons attacked not just the red ships that assailed the six duchies, but the white ships that were the cruel tools of the Pale Woman. It was strange for me to be caught up in true battle. I did not like it.
No one does, I assured him. I put my brow back down on my knees and closed my eyes.
I suppose not. But this time, flying with her, it was different. There was no killing to witness, no other dragons flying beside us. Instead, it was just she and I. I sat behind her and put my arms around her slender waist. She is a part of the dragon, you know, not a separate creature at all. Rather like a girl-shaped limb, more than anything else. So she did not speak to me, yet, strangely enough, she did smile, and from time to time she would turn to look into my face or gesture to something on the world below us that she wished me to see. She flew tirelessly. From the time I climbed up behind her, and the powerful beat of her dragon's wings lifted us through the canopy of tree limbs, until the moment that we landed on the black sand beaches of Aslivjal, she took no rest. Nor did I. At first, we flew through blue summer skies of the lands beyond the mountain kingdom. Then higher we flew until my heart pounded and I was giddy over the snowy peaks and trodden passes of the mountains, and then back into summer. We flew over the villages of the mountain kingdom. They nestle into the crooks and flanks of the mountains, and their flocks are scattered over the steep pastures like white apple blossoms litter the orchard meadow after a spring windstorm. I saw it in my mind, and smiled faintly when he spoke of flying over a six duchies hamlet early in the morning, and the one lad who looked up and saw them, and ran whooping into his cottage. And on he spoke, of rivers like silver seams in the land, and planted fields like patchwork when seen from above, and of the ocean, wrinkling like paper tipped with silver. In my mind I flew with him. I must have fallen asleep, lulled by his strange story. When I awoke, night was deep all around us. The camp outside our tent was still, and his pot fire held only a single flickering flame on a wick in the oil. I was huddled beneath one of his blankets, fallen over sideways on his bed. He slept, curled like a kitten, his brow nearly touching mine. On the other end of his pallet, his breathing was deep and even, and one long hand was palm up on the blankets between us, as if in offering, or beseeching something of me. Sleepily I reached over and set my hand in his. He did not seem to wake. Strangely, I felt at peace. I closed my eyes and sank down into a deep and dreamless slumber.
Chapter 19. Below the Ice.
The Out-Islanders have always been raiders. In the years before the Red Ship Wars, there were raiding incidents. As it seemed, there had always been. Individual ships led by the Kaimpra of a clan would make a quick strike, carrying off stock, harvested crops, and occasionally captives. Bairns took the brunt of these clashes, and seemed to relish them much as Shokes enjoyed its border disputes with Chalced. The Duke of Bairns seemed content that they were his concern, and made little complaint of dealing with them. But with the appearance of the red-hulled ships of Kebel Rawbred, The rules of engagement changed. Suddenly, the ships appeared in groups and seemed more intent on rape and ruin than on a quick acquisition of goods. They burned or spoiled what they could not carry off, slaughtering herds and flocks, torching grain in the fields and storehouses. They killed even those who did not resist them. A new malice had appeared in these raids, one that delighted not just in theft, but also in destruction and devastation. At that time, we did not even know of the Pale Woman and her influence over raw bread. Scribe Fedren, A History of the Red Ship War. In the morning, when we reached the edge of our pit, both Riddle and I groaned. Then we went to work, lifting and flinging the snow that had blown in to half fill our excavation of the day before. This snow was lighter and unpacked, but for all that it was frustrating work. It was like shoveling feathers, and half of what we lifted floated free to drift back to the bottom of the hole. It was nearly noon before we had cleared it all down to where we had left off the evening before. Then out came the picks, and we began to break ice and scrape it up and shovel it out again. I ached at first, and then I didn't, and then I began to hurt in new places. That night I dropped into an exhausted sleep deeper than dreams of regret. The wind blew again. Every night the wind blew. Every morning we began our task by clearing the previous night's drifted snow. Yet slowly, relentlessly, we toiled, and the pit deepened. When we could no longer throw the ice out of the pit, we dug a ramp at one end. After that, we shoveled the ice onto one of the sleds, and two men would drag it up out of the pit and away to dump it. The task was beyond tedious, and we found no sign of a dragon in the bottom. Worse, my wit sense of him grew fainter, not stronger. The workforce grew after the first day. Our first addition was Prince Dutiful, rolling back his sleeves and taking up a pickaxe. Chade limited his participation to supervising. He reminded me of Sybil's cat, who perched at the edge of the pit and watched us with supreme lack of interest. When the Narcheska entered the pit, Dutiful stopped his work to warn her that the flying ice from his pick might injure her. She gave him an odd little smile, between sad and flirtatious, and cautioned him to be wary of the flying ice that her own pick might free. And then she set to work beside him, swinging her pick with a country girl's competence. She used to help dig the rocks out when we were preparing the new fields in spring, Pyotr observed. I turned to find him watching her with a mixture of pride and chagrin. Here, give me your shovel for a time, while you rest yourself. I saw his aim and surrendered my tool to him. After that, both Narcheska and Pyotr worked alongside us, with Pyotr taking care that he was never far away from his ward. The Narcheska seemed to take care that she was never far from the prince. It was the first sign of warmth Eliania had shown towards Dutiful in days, and the prince seemed to take heart from it. They conversed in quiet, breathless bursts, between pick-strokes, and took their rest periods together. Pyotr watched over them, sometimes disapproving and sometimes wistful. I think he had come to like our prince, despite himself. The witted coterie decided that it supported the idea of freeing the dragon, and hence had no qualms about helping with the digging. When the fool applied his wiry strength to both digging and moving ice, the Hetgerd representatives cautiously came to watch. By the third day they were helping to drag sled loads of snow and ice from the pit to dump it. I suspect that curiosity to see the ice-encased dragon was as much their motivation as any other. On the fifth day, Chade sent Riddle and young Hest back to the stored supplies on the beach. Pyotr was uncertain about sending them off, and cautioned them many times to follow the flags we had posted along our route, and not to wander from it. He looked grave and apprehensive as they set out. They took a sled, for they were to bring back food and the spare shovels and picks we had brought, now that he had a larger workforce. Chade also told them to bring back all the canvas, in the hopes of rigging a windbreak or cover for the excavation that might block the blowing snow that thwarted our efforts each night. I suspected they would also retrieve the rest of the little kegs of explosive powder. I wanted nothing to do with that when I thought of it in the evenings, but by day, when I was battling the ancient hard ice, I sometimes longed to discover what it might do. We dug on. If I paused to rest and looked at the sides of our pit, I could see the layers in the ice that marked the passing winters. Every year more snow had been deposited here, and every following year yet another layer had blanketed it. It occurred to me that we were digging down through time, and sometimes as I looked at the layers, I wondered when the ice I stood on had fallen as snow. How long had Icefire been down here, and how had he come to be here? Deeper we dug, and deeper, and still saw not one scale of a dragon. From time to time, Chade and Dutiful would consult with the witted coterie. Each time they assured the prince and his adviser that they still, from time to time, felt the stirring of the dragon's being. I agreed with them. Yet those consultations also made me aware that my own wit was substantially stronger than Dutiful's. I was not as perceptive as Webb, but I thought I was at least on a footing with Swift. Cockle was probably a bit stronger than Dutiful, and Civil stronger than the minstrel, but not as sharp as I was. It was odd, to be able to perceive that the wit might be a strong or weak talent in a man. I had always thought of it as a sense that people either had or didn't. Now I perceived that it was like an aptitude for music or gardening. The strength of it varied widely, just as skill ability did. Perhaps it was Thick's prodigious skill strength that kept him latched so firmly to the dragon. The little man seemed to have become a complete idiot, staring vacantly before him and humming. Occasionally he would pause and make small motions with his hands. Neither the tune he hummed nor his hand motions conveyed anything to me. Once, when I was taking my rest after a digging shift, I sat down next to him. Hesitantly, I set my hand to his shoulder and tried to find my skill ability. I had hoped the fierce skill fire that always burned in him would reignite my own talent, but nothing happened, except that after a short time Thick shrugged my hand away, much as a horse might shudder a fly from his coat. Even his interest in food had waned, which concerned me most of all. Not only Galen, my first skill instructor, but Verity had warned me of the danger of becoming too absorbed in the skill. It was always the first hurdle that new initiates had to leap, and for many it had been a deadly one. The skill instruction scrolls recounted many sad tales of promising students who were swept away in the skill current, losing all touch with our world as they enjoyed the unique contact that the magic provided. Eventually such people were so enraptured that they lost interest in food and drink, in talking with their fellows, and eventually stopped caring for themselves at all. One warned that such a skill user would become a great, drooling babe, and Thick seemed poised on the brink of such a decline. I had always supposed the danger was the fascination with the skill itself, for I had often felt that pull myself. But if Chade and Dutiful were correct, then Thick was being seduced not by the skill, but by the attraction of another, more powerful mind. I made several fruitless attempts to engage him in conversation, which drew minimal responses from him, until finally, in annoyance, he told me to
"Go away! Bothering a busy person is not polite!"
And then he went back to his staring and rocking. The skill remained dead in me. It was all the more frustrating in that Dutiful had made contact with Nettle. Twice he had touched minds with her, trying to persuade her of who he was and what he needed. The first time she slammed her walls against him, saying she was in no mood for silly stories, and why would a prince be trying to contact her in a dream? The second time she was more receptive, for I think he had piqued her curiosity. She even tried, with little success, to distract Thick from his preoccupation, though I think she did so more out of concern for him than to please the prince. Dutiful accompanied her on that mission, but could make little sense of the dream imagery she used. He could explain only that Thick seemed to have gone to a place where his little song was an essential part of a far grander piece of music, and he could not be lured away from it. It was a frustrating analogy. As for conveying the prince's messages to the queen, Nettle said she would make mention of her odd dreams to Cytricken, if chance afforded her a private moment with Her Majesty, but that she would not risk making a fool of herself before the ladies of the court. She had done that several times already, with her lack of court manners, and had no wish to give them any more amusement than she already had. That gave me a pang. If I had consented from the beginning to letting her know her history, and to her visiting the court, she would have grown up in the company of ladies and gentlemen, and would not have been shamed by her country ways. I wondered if Cytricken now groomed her, in both studies and manners, so that she might take up a role as secondary heir to the throne. I longed to be able to talk to Nettle, to find out how much they had told her of her heritage, and to give her my explanations for why she had been raised as she had. But my lack of the skill silenced me,
and I could only nightly beg of the prince that he be circumspect in what he told her. Daily we continued to dig. The work was back-breaking, and the food both limited and boring. Nights were cold and windy, and we looked forward to the men returning with canvas. But they did not. Chade gave them an extra day. And then, too, the Hetgerd men claimed to have glimpsed the black man circling our camp at night, but their offerings were never taken, and the flowing snow erased any tracks he might have left. In one of our nightly talks, the fool said that several times he thought he had felt the black man's presence and suspected that we were observed. I, too, had experienced that uneasy sensation of being watched, but could never see anyone spying on us. I suspected that Webb did, too, for twice he summoned Risk from her shoreside scavenging and asked her to fly over our camp. He told me that she saw nothing out of the ordinary, just snow, ice, and a few protruding rocks. In the brief times when we were not digging, eating, or sleeping, Webb would find moments in which to work on my wit with me. He said, without cruelty, that it was actually good that I was currently unpartnered, as it gave me more focus on the magic, without making it specific to one creature. He added that Swift, too, seemed to be benefiting from studying while unencumbered, from which I gathered that the lad's lessons continued as well as mine. When he was with me, Webb focused on making me see how the wit connected all living things, not just those of old blood, but all. He showed me how he could extend his wit and wrap it around Thick, to become more perceptive of his needs and feelings, even though Thick remained unaware of him. It was not an easy discipline to master, for it involved surrendering my own needs and interests to subservience to his. Watch a mother with an infant, any kind of a mother, human or beast. There you will see this done on the simplest and most instinctive level. If one is willing to work at it, one can extend that same sort of perception to others. It is a worthwhile thing to do, for it conveys a level of understanding of one another that makes hate almost impossible. Seldom can one hate a person if one understands that person. I doubted that I would ever achieve that level of understanding, but I tried. One evening, as I was eating with Dutiful and Chade in their tent, I tried extending my wit to include Chade. I let go of my own hunger and aching back and anxiety about my lost skill and focused myself on the old man. I saw him as clearly as if he were prey. I studied how he sat, his back straight, as if he were too stiff to even slump, and how he kept his gloves on while he spooned up the pallid mush that was our evening repast. His face was a study in contrasts, red nose and cheeks, while his forehead was pale with the cold. Then, as if I suddenly saw his shadow for the first time, I glimpsed an aloneness that trailed back behind him to his earliest years. I suddenly felt his years and the strangeness of a fate that had sent him, in his old age, to camp on a glacier alongside the boy he would make king. "What?" he demanded suddenly of me, and I startled, realizing that I had been staring at him. I scrabbled for an answer and then replied, "I was just thinking of all the years and times when I've sat across from you and wondered if I'd ever truly seen you at all." His eyes widened, almost as if he feared such a thought. Then he scowled and said, "And I'd hoped you had had something useful in your mind. Well, this is what I've been pondering. Riddle and Hest haven't returned with the supplies. They should have been back by now. Today I asked Webb if his bird could seek for them. He said it was difficult to convey to her that we wanted news of two specific men, rather as if I asked you if you had seen two specific gulls. He asked her to look for two men with a sled. He said she did not see them." Chade shook his head. "I fear the worst. We need to send someone back, not just to look for Riddle and Hest, but also to bring back the supplies we need. Longwick told me tonight we have food for 4 more days, 5 if he cuts the rations again." He rubbed his gloved hands together wearily. "I never thought it would take this long to dig out the dragon. All the reports had seemed to say he was near the surface, even visible years ago. Yet we dig and dig and find nothing."
"He's there," the prince assured him, "and every day we get closer."
Chade snorted.
"And if I took one step southward every day, I'd be getting closer to Buckkeep, but no one could tell me how long it would take me to get there."
With a groan, he got up,
Sitting on the cold earth, even with the several layers of bedding beneath him, was obviously uncomfortable. He moved slowly around the cramped tent, cautiously stretching his legs and back. "Tomorrow I'm sending Fitz to see what became of Riddle and Hest, and I want you to take Thick and the Fool with you." Thick and the Fool? Why? It was obvious to him. Who else can I spare from the digging? Removing Thick from the dragon's vicinity may restore him. If it does, then leave him with Churry and Drub on the beach with our supplies. Have him skill to us from there whatever news he has. But why the Fool? Because it takes two men to pull the sled when it's loaded, and I don't think Thick will be of much use to you at that. I suspect you'll have to put Thick on the sled to get him to move from here, and you are one of the few people who can manage Thick at all. So you have to be one of the ones who goes. Fitz, I know it's not an assignment you would choose, but who else can I send? I cocked my head at him. Then you aren't just trying to send the Fool and me away from the digging area before the dragon is uncovered. He sighed. If I sent you, and not the Fool, you would ask if I were trying to separate you. If I sent the Fool and not you, I'm sure you'd say the same. I suppose I could ask Webb to take Thick and another man for this errand, but he does not understand Thick's skill ability. And if something has befallen Riddle and Hest, well, I think you more capable of dealing with a threat than... He suddenly threw up his hands and said in defeat, "Do what you will, Fitz. You will anyway, and the Fool will only go if you ask him. I've no power to send him anywhere, so you decide." I felt a bit sheepish. Perhaps I had been looking for motivations that truly didn't exist. "I'll go, and I'll ask the Fool to go with me. To be honest, I'll welcome the change from digging. Make a list of what you want brought back." Privately, I had resolved that I'd scavenge any driftwood I could find on the beach and bring it back with me, regardless of how much weight it added to the load. Chade could do with a good roaring blaze, I decided, even if it only lasted one night. "Be ready at first light, then," Chade advised me. The Fool was not as pleased to leave the digging as I was.
"But what if they reach the dragon while we are gone? What if I am not here to defend him?"
"The Hetgird guardians and the witted coterie oppose killing him as much as you do. Don't you think there'll be enough? We were bedded down together, sleeping back to back for the body warmth just as we had in the mountains so many years ago. Truth to tell, I gained little from it, for the Fool's body had always felt cool to the touch. It was rather like sleeping alongside a lizard, I thought. Yet if he did not give off much warmth, the solid feel of his back against mine was a reassurance of camaraderie that I had not felt since Night Eyes had died. There is security in knowing that a friend has your back, even if he is sound asleep.
"I don't know. I'm too close to where all my visions stopped."
He paused, as if he expected me to ask a question, but that was a topic I did not wish to explore. Then,
"Do you think we ought to go?"
he asked cautiously. I shifted in the bed, groaning as my aching muscles complained. I don't think I thought much about it. Chade has been telling me what to do for so long that I simply accepted I should go, but I would like to know what has happened to Riddle and Hest, and I'd like to see if Thick recovers himself when he's moved away from the dragon's influence. And, I shifted and groaned again, I wouldn't mind a few days of doing anything other than shoveling. He was quiet. I was too, pondering his silence. I wondered what was making him take so long to make up his mind. Then I laughed aloud. "Ah, yes, I nearly forgot. I am the catalyst, the one who makes changes. And this would be a change in what you think you should do, so you cannot decide whether to oppose it or not." The silence stretched so long, I thought he had fallen asleep. The day had been the warmest we had had so far, making sodden work of our task. I listened to the wind and hoped the night's cold would crust the surface of the glacier and keep the wind from blowing snow into our excavation. I had almost dropped off to sleep myself when he said,
"You frighten me, sometimes, when you give voice to my thoughts. We will go tomorrow. We'll take this tent for shelter, shall we?"
"That sounds fine to me," I said, as I drowsed off.